today. I appreciate giving me your Wednesday. Tomorrow on the show, we will have Elizabeth Borelli from Nubius Organics, and she's also the coordinator of Race Against Climate Change, both happening in Santa Cruz. Have a great day. Stay tuned for the Peter B. Collins Show coming up next.
Megan insisted New Orleans will be rebuilt.
We fight for the existence of this city, and this city will recover fully, and it will come back.
But even as he promised New Orleans would overcome the hurdles, he asked the world,
pray for us.
I'm Mark Felder in New Orleans. Above all else, President Bush came to challenge critics who say the federal commitment to rebuilding New Orleans and the rest of the Gulf Coast has fallen short of its promises.
The citizens of this country thus far have paid out $114 billion in tax revenues, their money, to help the folks down here.
Visiting the first public school to reopen in the battered Lower Ninth Ward, Mr. Bush vowed that the federal commitment is strong. He said this city is better today than yesterday and will be even better tomorrow.
I'm Harley Carnes in New York. Time to go. Time to say hasta la vista. That is the message to Idaho Senator Larry Craig from two fellow senators today, John McCain and Norm Coleman. And from the other side of the Hill, Michigan Republican Congressman Pete Hoekstra.
For the good of the United States Senate, the good of the U.S. Congress, and for the Republican Party. I think it's appropriate and necessary for Senator Craig to resign from his position in the U.S. Senate.
The FAA accelerates the emergency inspection order for nuts that can shake loose in the wings of 737 airliners and create a fire hazard.
What the FAA is now saying is that the situation is serious enough that the airlines need to speed up their inspections of these late model 737s. Previously, the FAA gave them 24 days. Now they have just 10 days.
Richard Jewell, the security guard who, despite false accusations, was the hero of the Atlanta Olympics, has died. In 1996, he saved a lot of people by shooing them from a crowded Centennial Plaza before a booby-trapped backpack blew up.
He did very much try to get on with his life. He was a super nice guy. We all thought here that worked with him and around him. He was the type to be there to help anybody also. Yeah, he was a super nice guy in my book.
Dr. Johnny Worley, the coroner in Meriwether County, Georgia, where Jewell became a sheriff's deputy. He was 44. Another death in the news, the man who started the New York nightclub CBGB's, Hilly Kristal, has died.
One way.
Blondie, the Ramones, Talking Heads all got their start in his club at the Bowery. When he opened it, his plan was country, blues, and bluegrass, but punk rock was his money load. Hilly Kristal is 75. Wall Street, the Dow way up, 247 today. The NASDAQ gained 62. This is CBS News.
Hey, Tanya Roberts here, and I want to know, where are you going on your next romantic getaway? Well, how about 3 days and two nights in Las Vegas? And what about you don't pay a dime for it? That's right. Act like a high roller in Vegas and pay nothing for it. It's all part of our celebration of Vegas's newest five-star resort, Tahiti Village. We want you to get out of Dodge. Stir up a little romantic magic in the most exciting city on earth with a complimentary second honeymoon, all on Tahiti Village. Come on. You know you deserve it. You know you want it. Las Vegas is calling. Just stop what you're doing and call the special toll-free number, 866-40-GO-NOW. Oh, and as a bonus, if you call right now, they're going to throw in tickets to a hot show right on the strip. Can we say high roller treatment, baby? So call 866-40-GO-NOW for all the exciting details. That's 866-40-GO-NOW. Call now.
No drinking and flying at NASA, not before going to space. That's been proven now after an investigation into unsubstantiated allegations.
The investigation covered 20 years, more than 100 space flights. NASA's head of safety and mission assurance, Brian O'Connor, says astronauts are mission-oriented and more focused than ever before.
These crews are very, very busy on these flights. They have
absolutely no motivation to hold up a mission and be blamed for it.
Still, his recommendations include drug and alcohol testing and officially putting excessive drinking on the list of banned pre-flight activities.
CBS's Peter King at Kennedy Space Center. 57-year-old Wendy Smith was reaching through a metal fence to comfort a skittish horse at the FFA barn in Greenwich, New York. The horse was clearly bothered by the big thunderstorm that raged all around, and rightly so. Lightning flashed, dropped the horse, sent the woman flying. She still has headaches, says she can't find words sometimes. Harley Carnes, CBS News.
Giving your house a whole new look will put a smile on your face. So will saving money on it during the Labor Day sale at your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams Paint Store. From August 30th to September 3rd, save $8 a gallon on Duration coatings, 30% on our exceptional paints and stains, and 25% on select wall coverings, too. Hurry, sale ends Monday, September 3rd, for painting and decorating. For locations, visit SherwinWilliams.com. Some exclusions apply.
You've got to check this out. The amazing Labor Day Serta mattress event is going on this Thursday through Monday at Sam's Club. Experience super Serta savings on all mattresses all weekend long and only at Sam's Club. See details in Thursday's newspaper or go to samsclub.com. You'll save money and sleep easier.
Try a Serta mattress with a comfort test demonstration at Sam's Club, Saturday through Monday only.
Live from the left coast, it's the Peter B. Collins Show. Infused with dangerous San Francisco values like compassion, justice, and a living wage. Join the conversation toll-free at 1-888-5-PETER-B and be part of Peter B.'s America.
One, two, three.
Those who start wars never fight them.
Welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show today.
Those who fight wars, they never like them.
This is a program dedicated to using every means available to bring our troops home from Iraq and end the occupation. There's an effort in Sacramento to put it on the ballot next year. We'll talk about that to kick off the program today. New study out shows 2 million more Americans don't have health insurance. That number's up to 47 million. And the Democratic Congress is trying to do something, trying to extend more health care coverage to children in America. And the compassionate conservatives in the White House are threatening a veto and playing all kinds of games administratively to block it. Rachel Carson from Families USA will join us in half an hour. We're also going to talk about the cost of high school dropouts in California. Dr. Russ Rumberger from UC Santa Barbara will join us next hour. Plus, Larissa Alexandrovna, the managing editor of investigations at rawstory.com, returns today with a fresh report about Dick Cheney's plan to attack Iran. Also on today's program, we continue our efforts to save Progressive Talk Radio in San Diego. We'll give you the guy who's the decision maker and invite you to send an email to him. And we're going to talk about Senator Larry Craig, who is not gay. He says,
forever, they can defend them.
No. You're invited to join the conversation. 888-5-PETER-B is our toll-free number. That's 888-573-8372. And you can always email me, Peter, at peterbcollins.com. To start the show today, we turn to Sacramento, where John Laird, the Democrat who represents Santa Cruz and Monterey in the Assembly, also chairs the Budget Committee in the lower house. John, welcome back to our program.
Hey, Peter, it's great to be with you. It's been too long.
Well, you appear unscathed from the 52-day summer budget battle.
Oh, that's because it always looks outwardly unscathed. I'm doing fine, but the governor's vetoes and some of the things that happened at the end were a very disappointing end to a very long process.
Well, I want to talk about that, but first up, I want to talk about the measure that passed through the Assembly on a party line vote just 2 days ago and some of the comments you made on the floor.
This is in support of an initiative which, if the governor signs off on it, will appear on the presidential primary ballot on the 5th of February next year in California. And it permits voters to offer a non-binding sense of California that it's time to end the occupation and bring our troops home from Iraq. First of all, I appreciate your support, and I appreciate that the leadership, including Don Parada in the state Senate, have seen this as something worthwhile and important. And politically, it might bring certain voters out to the polls, but a presidential primary usually attracts many of those same people. First, I want to ask you, John Laird, is this something that is satisfying and gratifying for you because you are constrained as a state legislator? You're not supposed to weigh in on foreign policy issues and the big national issues, but certainly as an elected official and somebody who's well in touch with what's going on, you've got a lot of opinions, a lot of passions, and so sometimes you must chafe a little bit at not being able to really express yourself on national issues.
That's true, and in some ways the difficulty is that as budget chair I'm in a position where I bear the brunt of the national decisions without being able to have a direct input or talk about them. And the perfect juxtaposition right now is here we are in the Iraq war, they're passing continuing resolutions with unspecified amount of money, and the Bush administration not only does not want to expand health care to children, it wants to actually pull it back and try to restrict what even is there now. And it's a perfect juxtaposition on national priorities, so it's nice to be able to make a statement as we're trying to extend health care to kids and lobby the federal government to do the right thing, but at the same time, in the scheme of the overall priorities, we're able to make a statement. It was also gratifying for another reason, and that is that at the time that the war began in 2003, I had just entered the assembly a few months before, and of the 120 legislators at the time, 52 of us signed a letter asking the president not to go into the war. And I referred to that letter in the floor debate earlier this week because it was very unpopular. The war was popular at the time, and we took the unpopular position, and the letter's very prescient. It says, we really don't know the stability of the country. We really don't know how we'll get out. We can see that it's going to change priorities in your federal budget. There's no absolute proof on the weapons of mass destruction. I mean, that's all in this letter that was signed by 52 legislators in March of 2003, and we were attacked vociferously at the time when that was an unpopular stance. And then they said 2 days ago, and we debated this on the floor, oh, you're just doing this because it was popular. And it's sort of like, where were you? You know, when it really could have mattered and it was unpopular, we were there.
And John Laird, in the debate in the assembly, were there any Republicans who stepped out of party discipline and expressed themselves honestly in opposition to the continuing occupation and the policies of the Bush administration?
Not really, but there was one incredible speech, and it was one of those ones. Paul Cook, who's a Republican from sort of eastern Riverside County, and he was a former professor at a community college, but he was also a Marine for over 20 years, and he stood up, and he gave a speech for our side, and then at the end said he was voting against the resolution. He stood up and he said he had buried Marines and that the premises of this war weren't well thought out and there have been incredible mistakes made in its administration. Mm-hmm. And he went through and gave essentially a speech against it and then in the end said, but I don't think this is well thought out. I'm going to vote against it.
Well, you know, the Democrats in Washington are having the same problem that you can get people like John Warner to make a public statement which distances himself from the party line, and then he falls into the party line whenever it's time to vote for more money or to resist Democratic attempts to put restrictions on the president.
Oh, and Warner's latest speech was considered a big break with the administration, and at the end he said, oh, in the next 6 months, take 5,000 troops out.
Yeah.
That was considered a break with the administration.
Yeah. Well, and you know, he laid down this gauntlet and then said, well, do whatever you want, Mr. President. We won't, you know, we won't put demands on you except that you give us some sort of a PR shift. And certainly, you know, 5,000 troops, there's no mention of contractors, and at 160,000, the official count of uniformed troops, 5,000 is a pittance, and it's an insult to the 155,000 who would be chosen to remain.
And that was the, you see, that was the hardest argument about the debate on the floor, is people tried to argue that it was undermining the troops to oppose the war. And it was sort of like, on the wrong pretext, we entered the war, and people overrode our arguments on that, and now somehow we're not being true to the troops unless we leave them in there. Mm-hmm. The word treason was actually used by one person in opposition to the resolution.
And did they trot out cut and run, John?
They didn't get to that, but I sort of stood up and they kept bringing up World War II, and mm-hmm. I just stood up and said, I really don't think there's a single person on this floor that would have been in favor of Hitler or fascism during World War II. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a false choice, and sort of tried to go through that before I went into the arguments for the resolution.
Will Arnold Schwarzenegger sign this, presuming it's pretty clear the Senate will pass it along party lines, but it's unclear what the governor will do?
I'm going to be surprised if he signs it, but he's got himself in a box because basically the Republicans in the legislature opposed it, but he has generally said on other initiatives the people need to decide, and it's pretty hard to say. The people need to decide except when I decide they shouldn't decide, and at the same time, have all the Republicans on the other side. So he's sort of boxed in. He's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to be surprised if he signs it.
I would think that they're going to prevail upon him to say that if you want to be a United States senator, or if you want to have a future with the Republican Party, you can't permit this to go on the ballot.
I think that's exactly right. And he was asked about it. We were at a press conference this morning on children's health insurance, where he came and he actually took a swipe at the federal administration on their children's health policy, but he didn't answer definitively the Iraq resolution question.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're going to take a break and return with John Laird. He's the Democratic Assemblyman who represents Santa Cruz and Monterey, and he chairs the Assembly Budget Committee. We're going to talk about the budget. It was finally passed and signed by the governor. It's now enacted. But there were major cuts used by Governor Schwarzenegger under his line item veto power. We'll talk about that with John Laird as we continue. And if you have a question or comment, you can call us now, toll-free, 888-5-PETER-B, 888-573-8372. Thanks for listening to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Yeah.
continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. It's 22 minutes after the hour. We're talking with Democrat John Laird, Assembly member who represents Santa Cruz de Monterey in Sacramento. He's also chair of the Assembly Budget Committee. And there goes Elvis Costello watching the detectives. John, before we talk about the budget battle over the summer and how it finally turned out, I just wanted to get your comment as an openly gay legislator, elected official, on the remarkable comments from Senator Larry Craig yesterday after he pled guilty to disorderly conduct and was accused by a police officer of trying to rustle up some gay sex in a bathroom in Minneapolis. And he made this statement, I'm not gay, I've never been gay. And I just wonder what your reaction is to this episode and to his statement.
Well, there's two reactions, and one is sort of the serious one, which is that it's interesting between Mark Foley and him and even David Vitter and some of the other Republicans or who are struggling with their private sexual issues and their public stances. It just sort of shows how false much of that standard is, and that having somebody accept the fact that they're gay and being truthful about it is increasingly no big deal and the right thing to do. And this just sort of graphically points out just the failure of sort of an alternative way of doing it politically. And I think, as unfortunate it is for the people involved, that they're trapped in this sort of ideological morass of their own choosing, that nevertheless it makes this point. And then on the, I don't know what you'd call it, the more humorous level or the more amazing level, I mean, it's just unbelievable. And I got to confess, because I happen to be a gay man that's pretty comfortable with being gay and have been out as an elected official for almost a quarter century, and it's no big deal, and I sort of, and you know, I have a partner of 12 years, I read about some of the stuff he said about the bathroom incident. I learned things I had never understood before about what the culture of that was, and was shocked by having to learn it from a Republican senator from Idaho.
Well, you know, actually, the part about reaching his hand under there, he's a neat freak, and he was checking for chewing gum that other travelers may have deposited there.
Well, that wasn't even half as bad, I thought, as just his public statement in the too much information category that when he goes into restrooms, he takes a wide stance. I just thought, I can't believe somebody's saying this in public. This is just embarrassing. And it's like, you know, we're supposed to be the liberals that sort of have a comfort with things that are unusual.
Right.
I just was like, oh, my God. Give this guy the bum's rush. And and I also thought, I haven't checked the voting record, I just assume he's somebody that voted for Bill Clinton's impeachment, and if he did as a senator on that vote, he should resign right now, and as a matter of great consistency.
Well, he was certainly outspoken. I would have to check, too. I do believe he voted for removal in the Senate, but he was quite self-righteous in his public comments at the time. Now, let's turn to the resolution of the budget battle, 52 days, and it was Republican holdouts who really dealt with the governor. And they made a deal with him to cut some of the programs that you were trying very hard to save, and in particular $500 million, I believe, in home health care and other funds for low-income Californians. And also they moved some money around to fatten up the reserves, and those seem to be the key demands of the Republican holdouts. What was the real bottom line for you, John Laird?
Well, a few points. First, you know, this is really hard for anybody that's not involved to understand, because it's inside baseball and what the arguments are. And the arguments are clear, and everybody deserves to know them on a public policy basis, which is the Republicans said this budget isn't balanced. Well, every budget proposal that had been made this year was legally and financially balanced, period, the end. The question was, is there's about $4 billion of money that's one time to the budget this year, and the Republicans were insisting that that $4 million of one-time money be the reserve, and that what the state takes in, it spends, with the one-time money being a $4 billion reserve. And they cut $700 million in conjunction with the governor to get to exactly that last thing. I mean, the budget we adopted had a reserve that was over $3.3 billion.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to get it up over four and cut that last $700 million. So that was kind of a joke in the sense of the state's fiscal condition. And secondly, we sent them a budget, the Senate. The Assembly sent the Senate a budget on July 20th, balanced $3.3 billion reserve, no new taxes, cuts in some programs. And it was 14 budget bills. The Republicans and Democrats approved it. It was a compromise. When the Senate approved the budget on the 21st of August...
Keep going, John, just about 30 seconds.
Yeah,
go ahead.
A month later, they didn't change a thing. There were two tweaks. They approved the exact same budget, and the governor vetoed. And vetoes were horrible. Libraries, homeless, mentally ill, non-credit courses at community colleges... really bad cuts that really hurt people, outreach for kids in health care.
Mm-hmm.
So bad things, not a good outcome.
All right, sir. Well, thanks for the struggles you take on behalf of Californians. And coming up in our next segment, we're going to talk about health care, particularly for children, and the federal SCHIP program. I know that's something you care a lot about. John, thanks for your work. Great to talk to you today.
My pleasure. Talk to you again soon, Peter.
John Laird, Democrat from Santa Cruz, who represents Santa Cruz and Monterey in the Assembly in Sacramento. Coming up next, Rachel Carson joins us from Families USA here on the Peter B. Collins Show.
live from the left coast, it's the Peter B. Collins Show, infused with dangerous San Francisco values like compassion, justice, and a living wage. Join the conversation toll-free at 1-888-5-PETER-B and be part of Peter B.'s America.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. Fresh evidence shows that even more Americans are living on the edge without health insurance. The for-profit healthcare industry keeps grabbing more of our dollars. And providing less in the way of healthcare services. Give me your money, please. Although I don't think they say please anymore. Rachel Carson joins us from Families USA. That is a nonprofit group in Washington, D.C. that has been fighting to improve health care coverage, benefits, and services for every American. And, Rachel, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And I think our timing is excellent. We had originally been planning to talk with you on Monday. There was a scheduling snag. And in the meantime, we have fresh evidence of the continuing problems that Americans face in getting health care coverage. 2.2 million more Americans than last year are living without health care coverage. And the impact on our children is rather dramatic. 11.7% of people under the age of 18 didn't have health insurance in 2006, and that's up from 10.9% in 2005. We're going to talk about the S-CHIP program, and this data indicates that the proposals to expand it and make it more accessible are needed more than ever.
That's right. We have seen an increase in the last year of about over 600,000 children who've become uninsured in the last year. And this is the second jump in a row that we've seen in the number of uninsured kids. And I think it's really an important time to find out about this and be talking about it, because Congress right now is in the middle of discussing a reauthorization of the Children's Health Insurance Program that has been so successful for so many years in reducing the number of uninsured kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to their credit, the Democratic leaders in the House and the Senate have seen this as an opportunity to use the new majorities to try to stop the rollbacks that we've seen under Republican leadership. And starting with S-CHIP and with coverage for people under 18, hope to expand health care and cut in to those huge and shameful numbers. 47 million? I mean, that's, almost one-sixth of Americans in the total population who don't have health care coverage. And it's shameful, it's obscene, and it's something that the Republicans, only talk about in terms of trying to give you, health savings accounts and other pro-business solutions that really come up short 9 times out of 10.
Well, that's right, and that's why I think this is such an important topic, because we have seen this year out of both the Senate and the House legislation passed that would invest significant new resources in the Children's Health Insurance Program, which was established about 10 years ago to provide coverage to working families who can't afford to buy coverage on their own, or they're not offered from their employers, but they earn too much to qualify for the Medicaid program. So what Congress is trying to do now is to provide states with new resources, $35 billion additional funding in the Senate bill, $50 billion additional funding in the House bill, so that states can continue to provide care through the CHIP program to the kids that they're already covering, and hopefully actually make a dent in covering even more uninsured kids.
Mm-hmm. And the $50 billion figure, that's over 5 years or over 10?
That's over 5 years. Both of them are over 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And those are really small amounts to invest in the health of Americans, and especially when you look at the way this administration and the Republican leadership in the prior Congress was willing to write blank checks. Hey, how much do you need for Iraq? It's $90 billion this time. It's $100 billion this time. Nobody bats an eye. Nobody threatens a veto unless, of course, the Democrats try to impose restrictions on the president's policies. And so when you compare the ease with which the Congress is willing to dish up huge amounts of money for this endless occupation in Iraq, and all of a sudden they become fiscally conservative when it's an investment in the American people, and in particular SCHIP, in our most vital resource, the next generation.
Well, you know, it's interesting because actually, you know, what we're looking at now is Congress willing to put money into, even if it's a drop in the bucket compared to what we're spending in Iraq, putting $50 billion or, you know, expressing interest in doing that into children's health coverage would make a profound impact and would let states go pretty far down the path. That $50 billion could cover as many as 5 million uninsured kids who wouldn't otherwise have health coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And the president has threatened to veto both the Senate bill and the House bill. He's also recently issued some new policy that would make it harder for states to provide coverage to kids even without that new money. But the president has said, you know, $35 billion is too much, $50 billion is too much. But I did notice today that he was asking for $50 billion more for Iraq for that would cover, I think, something like 4 months.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
As opposed to 5 years worth of health coverage for kids.
Mm-hmm. Now, those priorities are scary when you really look at them. Now let's talk about this veto threat and also these administrative hurdles that the Bush administration is trying to throw in the way in the event that SCHIP passes with veto-proof margins, and I'm not sure those votes are there yet. And that is that they want to establish a really high threshold for children in families to receive this coverage. So under the Bush policy, a family who earns more than 250% of the poverty level, which is about $50,000 for a family of four, must first document that the child has been uninsured for at least 1 year. And the state must then demonstrate that at least 95% of eligible children from families making less than that amount, or roughly that amount, are already enrolled in the Children's Health Insurance Program or Medicaid, and that's a barrier that no state has yet exceeded. So they're trying to put some very interesting roadblocks in the way of this expansion of health care coverage, and that seems really cynical and just downright cruel.
Well, and it's really contrary to what Congress is trying to do right now, which is to cover more uninsured kids and what states are trying to do. There are several states that have already increased their eligibility levels over 250% of the federal poverty level, and other states that are moving in that direction either this year or are contemplating doing it in coming years. And so this directive would really quash those efforts to move forward in covering more uninsured kids. And I think the president has really thrown down his gauntlet and said that he doesn't want to see more kids covered in CHIP, and he's going to get that one way or another.
We're talking with Rachel Carson. She's with Families USA, and she's with us for another 8 minutes or so. If you have a question or comment about health insurance, about the battle underway in Washington regarding SCHIP and coverage for children, call us right now, toll-free at 888-5-PETER-B, 888-573-8372. Now, Rachel, you're right there inside the Beltway, and I know you pay very close attention to these issues. What is your sense of the vote counts for SCHIP renewal and expansion in the Senate and in the House?
Well, you know, we had some really great votes in early August, just before Congress went on recess. And the bill that passed the Senate passed by a veto-proof margin, 68-31. The bill that passed the House was a majority passed it, but it was a little bit of a closer vote. And so what we have to figure out right now is what's going to happen when the two houses come together and try to produce a conference agreement that will take pieces of both bills and sort of put them together into one, and what the vote count is going to be. I think it's going to be really tough to find a veto-proof margin, especially in the House, just because of the way the politics work in the House. But we shouldn't forget that we have very strong bipartisan support from both sides of the aisle for the CHIP program because it has been such a successful program, and it is very popular among people in the states.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a lot of strong support for it. There's a lot of politics that have to go on. But it's very unfortunate that the president has issued this veto threat against either bill because it makes the whole thing a lot harder. But hopefully Congress will find the will to do it and
now,
overcome that.
If you happen to know, I wanted to ask you about one senator in particular, Gordon Smith of Oregon, where we have a number of listeners. He spoke at the Families USA conference that I attended in January of this year and indicated his support for it. Is he still on board?
He has been a very strong supporter of the Children's Health Insurance Program. He did vote in favor of the Senate bill, and he has continued to be very supportive, and we've been thrilled to have his strong support for the
mm-hmm.
program.
Good. And on the House side, who are some of the Republicans who are supporting this? Because those are the kind of people we need to know about.
You know, I actually don't have my list in front of me, which I should have had. But there are a number. There were about five Republicans who did vote in favor of the bill that passed there. And I think there are others who would like to vote in favor because they recognize how popular this program is amongst their constituents and how important it is to address the problem of the uninsured children. So
mm-hmm.
we're hopeful that we'll see even more of them vote in favor of the conference agreement.
And Rachel, without getting too wonky here, can you give us a little understanding of the mechanics of SCHIP? And whether this flows directly to citizens or if it goes through state programs. We have Healthy Families here in California, which has helped extend coverage, particularly to newborns to age five.
Yeah, so every state has its own children's health insurance program, and it does have a different name in every state. As you mentioned, it's Healthy Families in California. In Wisconsin, it's called Badger Care. In other states, it's called the Children's Health Insurance Program. So every state has its own name for it, and these are programs that the states have established. They either expanded their Medicaid programs, or they established a new program and gave it a new name.
Mm-hmm.
But the states operate these programs. They have a lot of flexibility to decide who qualifies. Most states cover kids up to 200% of the federal poverty level, but as I mentioned, many states have seen how successful these programs are, and so they're now moving to increase the eligibility levels so they can get more kids enrolled. And states have a lot of ability to decide what benefits are covered and who qualifies and whether or not there's a premium or cost-sharing amount that people have to pay when they're in them.
Mm-hmm. And, for example, under Healthy Families in California, the census report that was released yesterday shows that in 2004 there were 1.1 million individuals under 18 without health insurance in California. It went up to 1.3 in 2005, and I think partly due to Healthy Families, it declined to 1.2 million in 2006. And it does appear that the coverage will continue in California. Some of it is funded by the Proposition 10 tobacco tax. And that is helping to subsidize this because, as we know, Rachel, just before you came on, we were talking with the budget chair from the Assembly who talked about the budget battle with the governor this summer. And they did lose about $500 to $700 million in budget dollars aimed at health care for the poor. But the Healthy Families program was not touched, in at least to my knowledge. So this is interesting for California, but still, 1.2 million without health insurance, there's a lot of work to be done.
Well, and I know there's a big effort in California to move forward and try to expand coverage both to children and adults. And certainly, Governor Schwarzenegger understands, and I'm sure the state legislature as well, that the outcome of this reauthorization debate in Washington is going to have a big impact on the state's ability to do that, because in order to fund the expanded coverage for kids, the state's going to need significant new resources to do that. And so that's one of the reasons that we were so happy to see Congress willing to provide a lot of that funding,
mm-hmm.
And why it's so unfortunate that the president is opposed to it.
And Rachel Carson, what is your sense here? The House and Senate will reconvene after their summer recess next Tuesday, right after Labor Day. How quickly will SCHIP be taken up?
I think they're going to move fairly quickly. This was a very hot issue when they left for recess. And they really have just a couple of weeks to cobble together an agreement that they can vote on. The program is expiring on the 30th, and that's going to put that deadline is going to put a lot of pressure on them to move quickly. From everything we've been hearing, they're going to take it up as soon as they get back. They're going to work very hard, and they're going to do everything they can to pass a bill before the 30th that they can send to the president.
And, again, I this could be a tough question for you because it's detailed, but do we know who some of the key members of the House-Senate Conference Committee on this issue will be?
Well, we haven't gotten the list of the conferees haven't been appointed yet,
okay.
Mostly because everyone's been on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we know that there are a few key members who've been involved in this process so far and will likely stay involved, and they include Senator Baucus from Montana, Senator Grassley from Iowa, Senator Hatch from Utah, Senator Rockefeller from West Virginia. The four of them were really the architects of the Senate bill. There may be a few other folks from the Senate who will be involved in the conference. On the House side, it'll be Congressman Pallone from New Jersey, who chairs the Health Subcommittee of the Energy and Commerce Committee, and that's the committee that oversees CHIP in the House. Chairman Dingell, who is the chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee, and likely several other folks from the House, although we don't know exactly who yet.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, Rachel, thank you for this update, and I'm sorry that the information that has come out is showing further declines, but it hopefully will underscore to citizens and to our elected officials how important it is, starting with SCHIP, and that we need to follow through as California is attempting. I don't expect a bill to come out this year, but Schwarzenegger has at least signaled his willingness to work to extend health care coverage in California after he vetoed and actually helped repeal SB2 when he first came into office, which would have expanded employer-paid coverage for workers in California. So there's still a great deal of work to be done, and I'm glad that Families USA is there to represent us.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
Nice to talk with you. That's Rachel Carson at Families USA in Washington. We're going to take a break and return. If you want to offer a question or a comment about health insurance coverage, you can call me right now. Toll free at 888-5-PETER-B, 888-573-8372. It's the Peter B. Collins Show. It's the Peter B. Collins Show. Summer's not over yet, is it? Huh? I know Labor Day's coming, and that's the official end of summer, but can we stay in denial for just a few more days, put the top down, and enjoy this hot summer West Coast weather?
Got her next car, and she cruised to the hamburger stand.
Come on, Dad, don't take the T-Bird. It's the Peter B. Collins Show. It's about 6 minutes away from the hour. Coming up next hour, we're going to talk about the cost of high school dropouts to the state of California. And we're also going to talk about U.S. intentions toward Iran. The drums of war are beating loudly once again, emanating from Dick Cheney's office primarily. Larissa Alexandrovna from Raw Story will be with us next hour. And I want to thank Victoria from Columbus, Ohio, who listens online. The other day, after we got the news of Alberto Gonzalez's resignation, I put out the call, an all-points bulletin, for satirical songs that include Gonzo. And Victoria came through. She emailed this tune called Another Fascist Day. Let's take a listen. It's okay to sing along here.
It's another fascist day. All checks and balances gone away. The courts and the Congress in disarray. It's another fascist day. It's another fascist day.
And this is the perfect moment to share a little fascist comment. You know that guy on MSNBC? They used to put him in a bow tie, and now Tucker Carlson wears regular clothes. And to his credit, he gave up on Bush's war in Iraq. But he's still a pin-headed little twit, and I like to refer to him carefully as that little mother, Tucker Carlson. And after he heard about Senator Craig's little gay experience in the bathroom at the Minneapolis airport, he told a story urged on by Joe Scarborough and Dan Abrams about an incident that he said occurred in Georgetown when he was a high school student. He was in a bathroom, and he said in the original statement that this guy approached him and made sexual advances, and so he came back with somebody bigger than him, and he said he hit this guy against he hit his head against the stall, and then the cops came and arrested him. Well, he has now sanitized his remarks and said that 25 minutes later, a friend of mine and I returned to the men's room. The man was still there. My friend and I seized the man and held him until a security guard arrived. So he's now denying that he bashed his head against the stall wall.
You're being tracked by the NSA. It's another fascist day.
I think the Gonzalez reference is coming up here.
Fascist day. And if you should ever dare disobey, they'll send you on down to Guantanamo Bay. It's another fascist day. It's a beautiful fascist day. For Turd Blossom Scooter and Kenny Boy Lay, Abramoff, Gonzo, and Tom DeLay. It's another fascist day.
Thank you, Victoria. I enjoyed that one. That is Victoria and the Dust Bunnies, spelled D-U-H-S-T. We'll continue after the top of the hour news, right here on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Okay, CBS News. Sorry about that, folks.
For his GOP brethren to rally to his side, it's not happening. Three fellow Republicans in Congress calling for his resignation.
Republican support for Senator Craig is eroding.
He pled guilty, so I think he should resign.
Arizona's John McCain told that to CNN, as Minnesota's Norm Coleman said the same thing, citing conduct unbecoming a senator. Pete Hoekstra, a House Republican from Michigan, said Craig should quit because his denials are just not credible.
If he believes he's innocent, he ought to focus on clearing his name, and then once that happens, reevaluating and perhaps deciding to reenter public life.
Craig has told Republican leaders he'll give up his committee seniority during an ethics probe. Howard Arenstein, CBS News, Washington.
All this after it came to light Senator Craig's guilty plea to disorderly conduct in an airport men's room, conduct he now denies. Wall Street bouncing back.
I think what we saw was some good old-fashioned bargain hunting.
CBS News business reporter Alexis Christophorus on today's 247-point advance of the Dow.
We also got some welcome news from technology companies, which we haven't had lately. Seagate Technology was out with better-than-expected profit forecasts. Apple is expected to roll out the next-generation iPod next week. And we also had oil companies rally along with the price of crude oil, which is now topping $73 a barrel.
Best day of the year for the NASDAQ, up 62.5, S&P up 31 points. Right after it happened, he was vilified, erroneously linked to the 1996 Olympic bombing in Atlanta. But Richard Jewell was instead a very real hero, moving people out of the area when he spotted a suspicious backpack that then exploded. Richard Jewell dead today at the age of 44.
He did very much try to get on with his life. He was a super nice guy. We all thought here that worked with him and around him. He was the type to be there to help anybody else. So, yeah, he was a super nice guy in my book.
County Coroner Johnny Worley says there's no suspicion of foul play. Summer's almost over. Had your vacation yet? New report says 75% of us do not take all of our vacation time.
A number of these employees are not taking their vacations because they are filling other positions and working harder to get the product out.
Ronald Herzog, CEO, Fortune Personnel Consultant, says a lot of workers simply can't take vacation time.
Because of the labor shortage and the baby boomers retiring, most companies are not fully staffed at this point.
A lot of us work instead of play because we need the money. You're listening to the CBS World News Roundup.
Hey, Tanya Roberts here, and I want to know, where are you going on your next romantic getaway? Well, how about 3 days and two nights in Las Vegas? And what about you don't pay a dime for it? That's right. Act like a high roller in Vegas and pay nothing for it. It's all part of our celebration of Vegas' newest five-star resort, Tahiti Village. We want you to get out of Dodge. Stir up a little romantic magic in the most exciting city on earth with a complimentary second honeymoon, all on Tahiti Village. Come on. You know you deserve it. You know you want it. Las Vegas is calling. So stop what you're doing and call the special toll-free number, 866-40-GO-NOW. Oh, and as a bonus, if you call right now, they're going to throw in tickets to a hot show right on the strip. Can we say high roller treatment, baby? So call 866-40-GO-NOW for all the exciting details. That's 866-40-GO-NOW. Call now.
The FAA tells CBS News the inspections it ordered on Boeing 737 so far turning up four aircraft with the same problem that caused a China Airlines plane to explode in Okinawa. FAA today ordering airlines to speed up inspections of the wing slats on newer versions of the 737. They do not fly drunk. Latest astronaut drug and alcohol update from CBS's Peter King.
The investigation covered 20 years, more than 100 space flights. NASA's head of safety and mission assurance, Brian O'Connor, says astronauts are mission-oriented and more focused than ever before.
These crews are very, very busy on these flights. They have absolutely no motivation to hold up a mission and be blamed for it.
Still, his recommendations include drug and alcohol testing and officially putting excessive drinking on the list of banned pre-flight activities. Peter King, CBS News at the Kennedy Space Center.
Asthma, a growing disease. New guidelines unveiled by U.S. federal health experts today. CBS News medical correspondent Dr. John LaPook.
Time is of the essence in treating asthma. The earlier you jump on top of the symptoms, the better off you are. And what these new guidelines are emphasizing is that it's not only important to treat the symptoms when they're happening, it's important to prevent future episodes.
Time on the roundup, 7 minutes after the hour.
Hello?
Mr. Johnson, this is Greg's cell phone calling.
My son, Greg?
Yeah, I'm with him all the time.
I know what's up.
Yeah? What's up?
Well, the other night, Greg was at this cat's crib, and he was smoking a blunt.
What? I put the fear into that kid?
No, I meant the other dude. Greg passed.
Still, if he was there, let me talk to Greg.
Hold up. G's taking a test right now. I'm turned off.
And then how can...
Try us back after school. That's prime time.
Talking. The anti-drug. Learn more at theantidrug.com.
Paid for by Office of National Drug Control Policy.
There's nothing small about today's small business.
That's almost 3% of the gross state product for each California high school student who reaches age 20 without a high school diploma. And so, yes, there are true costs to these individuals whose lives will be set back by not having this basic credential. But we all are exposed to this cost as well. Russ Rumberger, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thanks for having me.
How long have you been studying dropout issues?
Oh, about 25 years.
Really? And give us that overview, if you will, over the past 25 years. Is California addressing the problem and are dropout rates declining, or is this still an issue that remains largely unaddressed?
I would say it's largely unaddressed. Clearly the state is doing something about it, but given the population that we have, I think we're not doing a satisfactory job.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about the estimates of economic losses from high school dropouts, because, again, I found this to be astounding but quite believable. You break it up into essentially four categories. Crime is rated at about 20% of the tab there, about $9.5 billion. And that, I think, is pretty easy for people to understand, that if you don't have a high school diploma, your options in the workforce are very limited. And it's quite understandable that many of those people will drift into drugs or other types of crime as a way to make a living and keep a roof over their heads. How did you arrive at the $9.5 billion figure?
Well, let me just point out that these are studies that I commissioned as director of the project, so I actually didn't do the studies myself.
Okay.
But I am familiar with the data and what the reports say. And that figure is really the cost to the victims of crime. The cost to the taxpayers is actually included in one of the other four categories that you mentioned. So This is just the estimated losses to crime victims, you know, in terms of robbery, having things stolen, death, of course, and other kinds of consequences of crime that affect the citizens of the state. So This is just the cost of crime to the victims, not the cost to the state to incarcerate people and prosecute them, for example.
So the cost of the youth authority and the prison system, is that included in externalities or in net fiscal costs?
Net fiscal costs are the government costs. So those would include the cost of actually incarceration and the police force and all those other things.
Okay. Then what is externalities cover?
Okay, the externalities is a little bit hard to understand. It's a concept that economists use to characterize the fact that when people are more educated, they actually improve the output of other people they associate with.
Hmm.
So if you have a more educated workforce, for example, you're more likely to have innovations in work, or you're more likely to improve the productivity of your coworkers. So having a more educated workforce actually improves the economic welfare, not of just the people themselves that are more educated, but the people that work with them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you attribute almost half of these losses, 48%, or about $22.5 billion, to loss in earnings. Is that the simple statement?
That's right, because we show what the estimated payoff to each graduate is over their lifetime. It's about $290,000 that they would earn. So if you these estimates, by the way, are for a cohort of about 120,000 students who dropped out. So if you do the math, it turns out that that's a huge, huge number, because those economic losses really add up.
Mm-hmm. Now, explain what the cohort means. Essentially, you couldn't analyze every dropout, and so I assume you took a cross-section and created this cohort, which includes people from different geographic areas, different racial, ethnic, and economic backgrounds. Is that the model?
Exactly. It's the whole population of 20-year-olds is where they did the analysis, because they wanted to allow enough time for the fact that some people who may not complete in 12th grade could eventually come back and earn a diploma later on. So they did the estimates at age 20, and then they looked out basically over the work lives of these individuals from age 20 to about age 64 and said, okay, over those lifetimes of those workers, or of those people, you know, what's the impact in terms of earnings, crime, welfare, health expenditures, and things like that.
And to look at the universe of dropouts, in 2005, almost one out of every four adults aged 18 to 64 in California, more than 4 million individuals, had not graduated from high school. For individuals who are black or Hispanic, one in three is a high school dropout. Even allowing for those who graduate late or get a GED, each year 120,000 individuals will fail to graduate by the time they're 20 years old. Now, has the enhanced testing required under the federal No Child Left Behind actually produced a spike in dropouts and people who fail to graduate?
I'm not sure that we can say that. It does look like the recently imposed high school exit exam had increased the spike last year, last year being the first year that it was required. So it looked like the dropout rate went up about an extra 20,000 students. So in the short term, it's having this effect. In the long term, I guess the hope is that as the students get more familiar with what the test requirements are, that they'll work harder to pass the test. But right now, there seems to be somewhat of a spike due to that fact alone.
So now that we have at least a grasp of the picture and the cost to the state, do you then turn this into an opportunity to realize savings by investing in continuing education, in non-traditional workplace education, you know, vocational type training for new industries? What are some of the recommendations that you're working on to address the problem and help reduce this loss?
Well, we haven't finished the study, so we still have some other studies that will be coming in to look at some of the things that we could be doing. But the second study, we actually released two of them, and the second study did look at some interventions that have been shown to improve graduation rates. They analyzed the costs of those programs, and they compared that to these losses, and then estimated that the state would actually get a return of between $2 and $4 for every dollar if they invested in one of these five programs that they found to be proven to be effective. So we actually have some evidence already of some proven programs that would likely improve our graduation rates and actually generate an economic return to the state.
We're talking with Russ Rumberger. He's a professor of education at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and he is the director of the California Dropout Research Project. If you have a question or a comment, you can call us right now. He's with us for another segment. Toll free, it's 888-5-PETER-B, 888-573-8372. And what kind of reaction have you gotten to the publication of this report, Professor?
Well, I mean, it's been pretty favorable and a lot of interest. The way you expressed it, you know, somewhat of surprise over the magnitude of the costs that are associated with this problem, and a lot of interest in trying to do something about it. So there's a lot of interest, I think, statewide and a lot of recognition statewide that we have a big problem in the state on dropouts and we should be doing something about it.
And in your view, what is the appropriate approach just in terms of structure? Should this be top-down from Sacramento, or do we need to provide a variety of resources and allow local school districts and even other entities that might not be a school district that might provide help vocational or post-secondary education of a non-community college type? What do you see as some of the, infrastructure or resource needs that we should be thinking about to address this problem?
Well, I think it's both a local issue and a state issue. Clearly, ultimately, the problem has to be solved at the local issue. But the state can do a lot in terms of providing resources and actually information, because it's important that schools and communities, if they're going to try to address the problem locally, have the correct information to make good decisions about where to invest their own money and their own time and energy to address, to look at this and improve the graduation rate. So we have to be careful, because we really want to make sure that we're spending our money wisely on things that have really been proven to be effective and not just put the money into something that we think might be a good idea.
And I think that's part of the problem, in that, the impression that many people have is that Sacramento will throw some money at a problem, but often they end up complicating the delivery of services funded by those dollars.
That's right. I mean, there's a history in Sacramento of basically, if there's a problem, put some money in it. Here's another problem, put some more money in it. So schools are kind of inundated with all these programs with dollars attached to them. They don't have a lot of flexibility in how they spend those dollars. So I think there is a realization in Sacramento that simply putting more programs and money, I should say, into some kind of program to address the dropout problem is probably not the best way to do it. But on the other hand, we don't want to. Schools still need some guidance, I believe, in knowing and having a better knowledge base on where to invest that money.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break and return. If you have an issue related to a high school dropout, maybe somebody in your family or somebody you know, and you'd like to talk about this issue, give us a call right now, toll free at 888-5-PETER-B. And maybe you are an educator and you're on the front lines of dealing with students who don't make the grade. Why don't you call with your first-person experiences? We'd love to hear them. 888-5-PETER-B. That's my toll-free number. You dial 1-888-573-8372. You can also email me, Peter, at peterbcollins.com. More coming up here on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Yeah.
talking about the cost of high school dropouts on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology.
What about that trigonometry?
Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you.
And wouldn't it be a more wonderful world if everybody could graduate from high school and even go on to some form of post-secondary education? Some 4 million people in measured in 2005, which is one in every four adults, have not graduated from high school here in California. Dr. Russ Rumberger from UC Santa Barbara is leading the charge. He directs the California Dropout Research Project. And I'm going to give you a somewhat lengthy URL here, so get ready to write it down. You might try Googling Dropout and Rumberger. You might be able to come across it that way. But the report is available to you at lmri.ucsb.edu/dropouts. One more time, lmri.ucsb.edu, /dropouts. Now, Professor Rumberger, if you can, help us understand the nature of the problem and how it is distributed in California today. Are there a lot of suburban schools that have a high dropout rate, or is it as many people imagine, that most of the problems are in ethnically concentrated districts in urban areas?
Well, it's more likely to be in urban areas, but it's also in part because we have more people living in urban areas, as you know. So it's a combination of the fact that we know kids who are economically disadvantaged are more likely to drop out of school. Ethnic and racial minorities are more likely to be economically disadvantaged, and they tend to live in urban communities. So, yes, the problem is more concentrated in urban communities.
Mm-hmm. And is it also a function of the economics? You kind of referenced it there, but do low-income families have a higher propensity to produce high school dropouts?
Yes, they do.
Okay. And how do we address that? Do we need to deal with the issue at the family and the community level, or is it sufficient to try to work with the student in the school setting?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's insufficient to work with them in the school setting. I think we need to work with them in the school setting, and we can work with them in the school setting, but I think because so much of the problem does emanate from family background, then I think it's going to be insufficient to probably work with it at the school level. So we need to improve the welfare and the conditions of families directly if we can through income supports, health insurance, and things like that, or short of that, helping them maybe deal with some of the issues that families are dealing with themselves such that they can help their kids be more successful in school, mm-hmm. such as parent training programs.
And it does seem that the real crisis is in the African-American community. The probability of incarceration for black male dropouts is at 60%. I mean, that's just one cherry-picked statistic, but it's a telling one.
It is a telling one. But as you know, of course, in our state, the largest demographic group is Latino. So we have a relatively small African-American population. So even though the risks of incarceration are very great in that population, we actually are, relatively speaking, have many more Latinos than we do blacks. So that's, of course, the majority of the biggest group that's affected by this.
Mm-hmm. So, Professor, how do we turn this into a win-win policy situation where people understand that investing money in secondary education, dealing with people who are at risk for dropping out for some of the reasons that we cited, that this is a good investment on the part of California taxpayers? It will reduce costs in terms of pathologies like crime and also dependence on government services relating to welfare or food stamps. And at the same time, if we can produce more people with a high school degree or a high school diploma, it actually benefits the state because they earn more and then they pay more taxes over their lifetimes.
Exactly, exactly. So I think if there's anything I hope comes out of these studies is an education for the American the California taxpayer, I should say, that says if we invest money in this, we're not just doing it out of benevolence, out of a moral responsibility, even though some people may say that's good enough for them. but it just makes economic sense that the state would actually be better off economically, just economically, from making these investments, or making wise investments, I should say, in proven programs. So, yeah, I mean, I hope that it's a realization among the listeners and among the taxpayers to say it's not just spending money for the sake of spending money, but it's actually investing money. And that's the key term in my thinking, is the word investment.
Mm-hmm. Professor, just about 30 seconds remaining. Jack O'Connor hails from Santa Barbara. He is the state superintendent of public instruction. Has he seen your report, and do you have any reaction from him?
Yes, he's seen the report, I believe. We actually mailed it off. We had a press conference and everything in Sacramento last week, and we mailed copies to all the high-ranking education officials, state board members, governor's office and things. So I haven't heard from him directly, but I know he's received it, and I know he's concerned about it. He's made statements.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hopeful that people from the governor's side, the legislative side, from Jack O'Connell's office can all come together on this issue and generate some good solutions.
That's Dr. Russ Rumberger from UCSB. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Nice to talk to you, Professor.
Bye-bye.
Coming up next, our intentions toward Iran.
Wilson's Tire and Service now has three locations to serve you better, wherever you live. All three locations feature full service, friendly, fast, same-day service, or, in the words of hands-on owner Juan Escamilla,
"We're fast and fair, and service is job one at Wilson's Tire and Service."
Specializing in tire, brake, and alignment services with state-of-the-art equipment. Looking for friendly, fast, same-day service from experienced pros? Come to Wilson's Tire and Service. Now located in Santa Cruz at 1807 Soquel Avenue across from Walgreens, in Soquel Village at Old San Jose Road and Soquel Drive, and now in Aptos Village across the entrance to Nicene Mark State Park. Questions? Call 476-0370. That's 476-0370. Say hello to Juan and get the Wilson's Tire and Service full service.
Miguel Sarmiento, owner and chef of the Mexicali Grill in New Monterey, cordially invites you to visit his restaurant and enjoy quality Mexican food prepared with California seasonings and sauces. all with personalized attentive service. Miguel has more than 14 years of experience preparing Italian, Hawaiian, Mexican, French, and American dishes in restaurants throughout Monterey County. Looking to savor the best Mexicali cuisine served with great margaritas or fine imported or domestic beers? Visit the Mexicali Grill today, located at 204 Lighthouse Avenue at the corner of Reeside Avenue in New Monterey. The Mexicali Grill is open daily for lunch from 11 to 3 and for dinner from 5 to 9. For takeout orders, call 375-9801. That's 375-9801. Live Miguel has a message to all Central Coast residents who appreciate delicious, high-quality Mexican food at reasonable prices.
Todos son bienvenidos en el Mexicali Grill. Try it. You'll like it a lot. America.
Attack Iran? That's crazy.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions had an echo in so much space. And when you're out there, without care, yeah, I was out of.
The Peter B. Collins Show rolls on. Larissa Alexandrovna joins us again today. She is the managing editor for investigations at rawstory.com. Larissa, how you doing?
I'm good. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's great to talk with you again.
Yeah, it's almost like old times. Wednesday, it's 7:30. 7:30 my time.
Right. And there's Larissa. Well, and I want you to know that I was trying to follow the lead of our vacation happy president and take a good long one this year. And I did take 3.5 weeks off, which it breaks all the rules in radio. But, hey, I'm still here.
That's true. And, you know, at least I don't know who the other hosts were, but Brad did a great job.
Well, I got great reports on Brad, and Christine Kraft from Sacramento covered the second 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And by all accounts, did a good job, too.
You know, I'm sorry I missed her, but he did a fantastic job. So
well, and he was operating from Houston in 100-degree weather with floods coming and going.
Right. So considering even it's a miracle.
Yeah. Well,
so you go ahead, sir.
I wanted to catch up on your latest dispatch. We touched on this a little bit yesterday. Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, was on the program. And he published a piece at Alternet dated August 23rd, Are Bush and Company Gearing Up to Attack Iran? And you and Seymour Hersh and a bunch of other reporters have been all over this story for a year and a half now.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears, once again, that the U.S. is at least well prepared for a military assault on Iran. And it appears that many of the war games have been played out. And as we hear the rhetoric ratcheting up over the past few weeks, in fact, really the last few months, since Dick Cheney went and gave a speech facing Iran from an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf,
right.
It's become clear that this administration seems quite serious about finding a reason or some sort of a provocation to launch a major military assault on Iran.
Well, they've always been serious. It's just that they've never been able to quite get it off the ground. I think at this point, they have nothing to lose. You know, what I think is remarkable is what the president said yesterday, and I'm quoting him, I will take all actions necessary to protect our troops. I have authorized our military commanders in Iraq to confront Tehran's murderous activities. That's a declaration of war.
Well, and he gave it to a real hostile crowd at the American Legion.
Right. But it's one thing to call Iran the axis of evil. It's a whole other thing to say I've authorized our military commanders.
Mm-hmm.
That is saying I've given the order. You know, I was so alarmed by this that I was on the phone and communicating with people all of yesterday and this morning, and basically, the reaction is similar to mine. This was a declaration of war. And I think the most shocking thing that was said to me was basically a really, really senior person said to me, no one can stop this now.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I mean, that's verbatim. No one can stop this now. It's
yeah.
done.
Well, in the last 48 hours, we took custody of a group of Iranians who were visiting Baghdad at the invitation of the Iraqi government.
Again.
Right.
Right. But we let them go.
Oh, we have. I missed that.
Yes, we've let them go and said, oh, you know, we're sorry. Or I don't even know if we said we're sorry. We just said it was unfortunate or something equally as ridiculous of a statement.
Mm-hmm.
No, but they've been let go now.
Okay.
So it's like we scooped them up. Just it's like we are antagonizing Iran into a first strike. Iran, however, I don't think it's going to do anything. What concerns me is that getting desperate, we're going to end up with a Gulf of Tonkin situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, but back to the report. The article I did on the report yesterday.
Yeah, I want people to go to rawstory.com and read it because it's detailed and has a lot of fresh information. Tell us about Dr. Dan Plesch. We've interviewed him once or twice before. He's in London at the Center for International Studies and Diplomacy.
Right, at the University of London. That's
mm-hmm.
right. He and Martin Butcher, who is a security expert, he's worked with the European Union, the Parliament of the European Union, on security issues. They put together a report using open source materials. That is to say, they've connected the dots using all sorts of articles over the last couple of years, plus their own assessments, into a cohesive kind of analysis of basically what we're going to be doing in, and they've reached some really interesting conclusions, as you've probably read by now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not the least of which is we're ready to go, and we can do it in a matter of hours if need be on Bush's order.
Let me lift this quote from your piece here, and you're quoting Dan Plesch here. The study concludes that the U.S. has made military preparations to destroy Iran's WMD, nuclear energy, regime, armed forces, state apparatus, and economic infrastructure within days, if not hours, of President George W. Bush giving the order. The U.S. is not publicizing the scale of these preparations to deter Iran, tending to make confrontation more likely. The U.S. retains the option of avoiding war, but using its forces as part of an overall strategy of shaping Iran's actions. Now, that list there, okay,
right.
WMD, we know that they have uranium enrichment facilities at Natanz
right.
and a couple of other sites. We know that they have an interest in developing, at least as a first step, nuclear electrical generation. But then this list includes regime. That's a pretty broad reference to the entire government, the armed forces, state apparatus, and economic infrastructure. I mean, that covers everything except
the kitchen sink.
Yeah, or a 7-Eleven, maybe.
Well, you know, I think I should point out that, you know, the other people I've talked to think that this report is terribly optimistic in its estimate of the success rate we're going to have with our strategic bombing of sites. So, given, you know, I think taking into account that we'll likely not be very successful in terms of our targets, if we assume we hit everything else, then that pretty much summarizes the report.
Well,
you know?
and the report.
And I don't mean to be laughing. I'm just, you know, I think it's out of nervousness at this point that we are in really bad way here.
Mm-hmm. So here again from your article, any attack is likely to be on a massive multi-front scale, but avoiding a ground invasion.
Right.
U.S. bombers and long-range missiles are ready to destroy 10,000 targets in a few hours.
Yep.
U.S. ground, air, and marine forces already in the Gulf, Iraq, and Afghanistan can devastate Iranian forces, the regime, and the state at short notice. Now, this is where, pardon me, it seems to kind of go off the charts and get into a kind of video game sensibility. That is that we can conduct these raids using bombers and missiles that are land-based or sea-based, conduct 10,000 sorties in a very compressed period of time, and suffer no repercussions whatsoever. Now, I know that Iran doesn't have much of a navy, doesn't have...
Actually, it has a fairly good navy.
They do?
Yeah.
All right, that surprises me.
No, that's the one thing they really, really have that's, for example, that some of the other... We want to reduce Iran to a third world nation without a really... It's not an exceptional navy, but they've got a fairly good operational navy, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that gives, you know, just one indication of how, given the situation, if they find themselves under a massive assault,
right.
I have to imagine that the Iranians have some sort of plans for retaliation. It might involve the carrier groups that we have deployed in the Persian Gulf. That might involve an offensive inside Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of different ways that Iran can really F with the United States.
Right. And I would also say that it's not restricted to within those two countries, Iraq and Iran. I mean, they have assets all over the world that could be activated fairly quickly, including in the United States. And thus far, you know, and I've reported on this before, Hezbollah, for example, you know, operates in the Americas mainly to raise funds. So it's you're not seeing violent type of operations. You're seeing, you know, kind of white-collar crime type of operations. So, you know, they're selling, like, phony Viagra and, you know, things like that. But if Iran were under attack, those assets could be made into active boots on the ground. And I don't understand why this administration, or maybe they do, I don't know, doesn't realize that, you know, Iran can activate these assets as well as assets all over the world, and I think also that moderate Muslim type of governments will become radicalized as well, and so, you know, we can expect some retaliation from them. And not the least of the allies on that side is Russia and also China.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's not just a matter of, you know, well, they can kind of hit our carriers. No, I mean, this could turn into a I hate to use World War III, but when you've got definitive sides like this, where you have Russia, China, Iran on one side, and, you know, basically us and France on the other side, and Israel, you know, this would look like a world war type of activity.
Well, and you mentioned Hezbollah. I think that's a very fresh example, just a year old, that shows that, extensive bombing and use of aerial assets, such as Israel attempted against Hezbollah in Lebanon last summer, has limited potential. And
right.
That guerrilla groups can survive to a great extent the aerial assaults that we can launch, and then they retaliate by attacking civilians and by opening up new fronts that the U.S. would then have to defend.
And cannot defend.
Right. Because
yeah,
because we're overextended and mired down in Iraq.
Right. Militarily, we cannot succeed. We cannot even... I don't even think we can keep the bombings going because we have to address the refueling issues. And the mess in Iraq, and you've got supply routes to the soldiers in Iraq that'll be cut off. I mean, there's so many issues here that it really is the most insane thing. And you know, that's why you played the crazy song at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's really insane. And what I don't understand is how anybody would go along with this. You know, my understanding is that there are military brass who will, you know, step aside or step down. And in my opinion, I would urge all military personnel to not follow this order.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a catastrophe on so many levels. And although these guys, Dr. Plash and Butcher, do not think we will use nuclear weapons, I actually believe we will, because it's the quickest, most efficient, and, you know, unfortunately the most horrific way to decimate an entire area and not have to worry about keeping the you know, the sorties going and all of that. They can do it fairly quickly.
Well, and particularly the hardened sites such as Natanz, where we believe that they've built well underground, the nuclear bunker busters are the weapon of choice. However, there are serious issues related to fallout. And, of course, Natanz is not in a deserted area. There are civilians nearby. And downwind, you've got a lot of Middle Eastern countries, including Israel, that certainly could be affected by any nuclear fallout.
Right.
So it's not.
I'm sure the United States is guaranteeing total success because we have a superior military with 100% accuracy in terms of targeting, which is nonsense.
Yeah. All right, Larissa, we got to take a break. We'll return in just a moment. If you have a question or a comment about this breaking story, the developing situation related to Iran, give us a call toll-free, 888-5-PETER-B. That number again is 888-573-8372. We'll continue in a moment on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Being reported right now, it is in, let's see, San Juan Batista, it's San Juan Road or Highway at Prescott Road. It's a rental truck that went off of the roadway, landed in the middle of a field. Now, CHP is actually on scene. Possible injuries being reported as well. Also want to take a look at Monterey, northbound Highway 1, the on-ramp to Fremont Street, injury crash, the motorcyclist down in the left lane. Emergency crews on scene, paramedics as well, obviously. Soledad, North 101 before Front Street, we have a bus that is apparently stalled out there. It's blocking the second lane from the left. And a quick look at Highway 17, no problems to report in either direction. This report brought to you by the NFL. 2007 NFL opening kickoff presented by Sprint, featuring performances by John Mellencamp, Faith Hill, Kelly Clarkson. Relive the Colts championship moment Thursday, September 6th at 8 p.m. on NBC, brought to you in part by EA Sports. That's traffic on KRXA.
Wisdom that any U.S. attack on Iran would be confined to its nuclear sites. Instead, they foresee a full-spectrum approach designed to either instigate an overthrow of the government or reduce Iran to the status of a weak or failed state. The wider form of air attack would be the most likely to delay the Iranian nuclear program for a sufficiently long period of time to meet the administration's current counterproliferation goals. It would also be consistent with the possible goal of employing military action to overthrow the current Iranian government. However, it's the option that contains the greatest risk of increased global tension and hatred of the United States. The U.S. would have few, if any, allies for such a mission beyond Israel, possibly the United Kingdom. Once undertaking, the imperatives for success would be enormous. And, Larissa, on the flip side of that, the imperatives would be quite daunting. We learned how difficult it is to put ground forces into Iran during the Carter administration, trying to recover our hostages at the American embassy in Tehran. And while it appears that we think we could do this mission completely, you know, from the air or sea, I think that the U.S. would quickly learn that Iran is a formidable force. They are very determined. And this government that we call a regime, I think, is quite determined to hold on to power.
Yeah, and I think if attacked, any dissidents or any individuals or groups interested in seeing a regime change within Iran, that is, Iranians, would likely back their own government. It would unite them as opposed to, light a fire under the other types of various movements in the country.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that, you point out that, that the U.S. should know that the issues here and that what types of commitments we would be stuck with and for a very long time. And the thing is, the military and the intelligence agencies do know this. The only people who appear not to know this or wish not to know this or simply don't care are those in the White House. And this is what I keep coming back to over and over in my discussions with folks is that, we'll go back and forth and they'll say, well, but the military knows this can't be done. And, I keep saying, okay, but you're Dick Cheney and you say, I don't care, find a way to do it. Can it be done then? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, as I said, before the break, if we have, even if we have military brass who does step aside, the reality is that there's always someone ready to take their place, be promoted and whatnot. And so whatever mission they've set out, in my opinion, is not going to be stopped. The other thing is I reported last week that we've already, something in the way the CIA is operating with regard to Iran has changed. If you recall, I did a story a while back discussing that the CIA had been given approval to conduct black propaganda and sabotage type of activities, but nonviolent activities. My understanding is that has now changed, although I'm not provided with particulars. And not only has it changed, but it's been ramped up.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take that into account and you combine that with what the president just said yesterday and you combine it with this report, it appears that we are now where we were in March of 2006, and that is, at a precipice.
And so I always like to make sure that we offer appropriate criticism for those who aren't speaking out about this. The Democrats, of course, removed from the supplemental that they caved in and passed in at the end of May,
right,
a prohibition on an attack on Iran without explicit approval from Congress. Do you believe the Democratic leaders are fully briefed on this, and why aren't we hearing them speak up with their concerns?
Because they'll support this. Because it's being pushed by...
AIPAC.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was trying to find a polite way of saying it. You know, I keep trying to remind people that AIPAC no longer really speaks for the Israeli government, not even its far righties, in the same way that the Bush administration no longer speaks for the United States government or even our far righties. I mean, these people have, you know, kind of abandoned their national, their nations, and mm-hmm. sort of are acting as a corporate conglomerate of, you know, various states operating in their own self-interest.
Yeah. And I would encourage people to research carefully the positions of Democratic candidates for president. In particular, John Edwards has made some remarks about Iran that are quite troubling.
And Obama also.
Yeah, Obama doesn't seem to have, well, restraint on that issue. I'm out of time here, Larissa. Thanks for some great work, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Read
all about it at rawstory.com. Coming up next, the Free Speech Zone. Your calls and comments are welcome. Any subject, any viewpoint. Call me from anywhere you're listening. 888-5-PETER-B. 888-573-8372.
Listen to KRXA 540, Carmel Valley, Monterey, Salinas, and Santa Cruz. Think for yourself.
CBS News, I'm Jim Taylor. Senator Larry Craig is losing his ranked position on several Senate committees and losing supports.
A conservative Republican congressman from Michigan, Pete Hoekstra, says it's hard to believe Senator Craig's denials.
I didn't think they had a lot of credibility.
And Hoekstra thinks Craig should quit.
For the good of the United States Senate, the good of the U.S. Congress, and for the Republican Party. I think it's appropriate and necessary for Senator Craig to resign from his position in the U.S. Senate.
Minnesota Republican Senator Norm Coleman issued a statement saying Craig should resign, and Arizona Republican Senator John McCain told CNN that Craig should quit, too. Howard Arenstein, CBS News, Washington.
The senator has said he didn't do anything wrong, that he is hiring legal counsel to look into his guilty plea to disorderly conduct in an airport men's room. The bells are tolling for those who lost their lives into Katrina. It happened 2 years ago, a storm of criticism following the hurricane, but today an upbeat New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin.
Our people are coming back, ladies and gentlemen. We're 300,000 strong and growing every day.
About all that criticism, President Bush there to address that.
All too aware of criticism that he hasn't delivered on his promises to rebuild the region ravaged by Katrina, President Bush offered assurances to the contrary. First in New Orleans, and then on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi.
So one of the reasons that Laura and I have come back is to remind people that we haven't forgotten and won't.
In a statement staged to showcase the rebuilt bridge across St. Louis Bay, Mr. Bush conceded there are still obstacles to overcome, but that the federal commitment to the region is strong. Mark Noller, CBS News, New Orleans.
The White House, the power of heat.
With temperatures in both Central and Southern California approaching or surpassing 100 degrees, power usage is higher than expected. And the agency which operates California's power grid has declared a Stage 1 emergency. Under this Stage 1 declaration, consumers are asked to voluntarily cut back on electrical use. Officials at this point do not expect to have to put into effect mandatory blackouts.
Richard
Steve
Jewell.
Futterman, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Richard Jewell is dead. Remember?
Richard Jewell went from Atlanta Olympics bombing hero to villain. He called attention to a suspicious backpack
that contained a bomb and helped clear the area before it detonated, July 27, 1996. Just a few days later, media outlets reported that Jewell was the FBI's chief suspect. He was later cleared of any wrongdoing.
CBS's Jim Crisula reports that Jewell died in his home in Georgia from natural causes. He was 44. When he opened the dingy nightclub in New York's downtrodden Bowery in the mid-70s, Hilly Crystal wanted to feature country, bluegrass, and blues. He called it CBGB. Along came punk and everything changed. Talking Heads got their start there. Hilly Crystal losing his battle with lung cancer. He was 75. This is CBS News.
Can you guess where's Michelin Man? He's heading off-road to the daunting River of No Return. Fortunately, Michelin Man will return because he has Michelin's new LTX AT2 tires with class-leading off-road traction and smooth on-road comfort. For more on LTX AT2 tires and Michelin Man's whereabouts, visit michelinman.com/guesswhere. Plus, enter to win a Via Michelin GPS.
Michelin, a better way forward.
Claim based on internal Michelin off-road evaluation versus select competition. No purchase necessary. See website for claim and promotion details.
Hey, Mr. Opportunity here, so you know what that means. It's Honda clearance time. And if you're into trucks, you are going to love this because it's your opportunity to get behind the wheel of a new Ridgeline, the versatile Element, the classy CRV, or an 8-passenger Pilot for a deal that just might make your head spin. Look, it's your money. I'm just trying to save you some of it. Your wallet can thank me later, if you get my meaning. Don't you just love it when I'm around? The 2007 Honda clearance. I'm Mr. Opportunity. I'm back. And I'm knocking. Clearance ends September 3rd.
A centuries-old mystery is solved. Here's CBS's Harley Carnes.
The question for years has been, who killed Beethoven? Turns out his doctor did it. Didn't mean to, says a pathologist in Vienna. Beethoven overdosed on a cure for fluid in the abdomen caused by a diseased liver, cirrhosis plus edema, or buildup of fluid. His doctor punched a hole in his abdomen to let the abscesses out, then sealed the little hole with a poultice that had lead in it. And over time, puncture and poultice procedure after procedure after procedure, Beethoven died of lead poisoning. Harley Carnes, CBS News.
In Rolling Hills, California, Francisco Linares is in trouble for a fence.
It's been a nightmare. I fixed a fence that I was supposed to be the responsibility of the city to fix originally, and after I fixed the fence, they accused me of planning the fence in city property.
Defying city orders to defense, he's going to jail for 6 months. I'm Jim Taylor, CBS News.
You've got to check this out. The amazing Labor Day Serta mattress event is going on this Thursday through Monday at Sam's Club. Experience super Serta savings on all mattresses all weekend long and only at Sam's Club. See details in Thursday's newspaper or go to samsclub.com. You'll save money and sleep easier.
Try a Serta mattress with a comfort test demonstration at Sam's Club, Saturday through Monday only.
What if you could buy peace of mind? Well, you can with Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury certified pre-owned vehicles. Everyone must pass a 115-point inspection, and it's all backed by our 6-year, 75,000-mile warranty coverage. That's peace of mind. Now get 3.9% APR on select Ford or Mercury certified pre-owned vehicles. That's just 3.9%. Not all buyers qualify for Ford credit financing. Offer ends 9/30/07. See dealer for limited warranty details or visit FordCPO.com.
Live, unscripted, and unrehearsed, of course. It's the unpredictable Peter B. Collins Show, originating from that dangerous liberal enclave, San Francisco. Call in anytime toll-free at 1-888-5-PETER-B and add your voice to Peter B.'s America.
Don't just call anytime. Call me right now, because this is the Free Speech Zone. Your calls are welcome. We even pay for the call. It's toll-free, 888-5-PETER-B. Every month I write the check myself so that you don't have to pay for the phone call. Oh, we've got a bevy of topics to pursue. We talked with Assemblyman John Laird about the California ballot measure that, if the governor approves, voters in the presidential primary will be able to express their opinion on getting the U.S. out of Iraq. We also talked with Rachel Carson about extending health care insurance to more Americans. Well, things are running in the other direction. An additional 2 million Americans have lost health insurance coverage just in the last year. We also talked about the cost of high school dropouts and the risk that we see growing with the Bush administration military assault on Iran. All those subjects are up for grabs, or you can introduce one of your own, like Larry Craig saying he ain't gay. Ah, thou doth protest too much, Senator. And I'm curious about your comments comparing the way Republicans are responding to Larry Craig's peccadillo with the way they responded to David Vitter's revelations. He was on the D.C. Madams list. So heterosexual use of prostitutes is okay, but trying to line up a little gay action in the bathroom at the airport, I guess that crosses the line. Where are those family values and who defines them? If you have a comment on that, I'd love to hear from you. Anytime this hour at 888-5-PETER-B, 888-573-8372. And before we go to your calls, I want to get an update from Aldous Tyler of nonstopradio.com. He's the guy who helped lead the charge to save progressive radio in Madison, Wisconsin. And now he has been helping out the folks in San Diego trying to resist Clear Channel's intention to flip the KLSD progressive talk format to a sports station. Aldous, welcome back.
Hello, Peter. How you doing?
I'm doing great, you agitator, you.
Well, you know, somebody's got to do it. Why not me? And actually, that's kind of the question I ask everybody is like, look, if you want to stay the station, you got to be part of it, you know, so why not you? Let's get going.
Yeah, well, it was great to see 500 people rolled out of bed early Monday morning and showed up at the radio station there to offer support for continuation of Air America and Progressive Talk at KLSD. We talked to Bree Walker about that yesterday. And in the meantime, Aldous, you have identified the decision maker who our listeners can send emails to politely, hopefully, lobby for the continuation of the format.
That's correct. And the fellow that we want to talk to there, his name is Bob Bollinger. He's one of the upper-ups in the station there, and I've been able to talk to the headquarters of San Antonio of Clear Channel, and they said he's the guy to talk to. And I actually talked to him directly on the phone this afternoon.
Oh, good.
And so he understands that he's going to be hearing from us. So here's the deal. We want to be polite people. We want to make sure that we're coming across who we are. We want to let them know that we're the rational side, that we're the side that thinks through what we're saying. So be firm. Let them know that we want Progressive Talk to stay on in San Diego. We want KLSD to stay the center of rational thought in San Diego. But make sure you let Bob know. And the way to do that is to email him at Bob Bollinger. Let me spell that. That's B-O-B-B-O-L-I-N-G-E-R. At clearchannel.com.
And no dot or anything in the middle, just B-O-B-B-O-L-I-N-G-E-R at clearchannel.com. And I do stress, as you do, that it's important not only to be rational and polite, but to understand the motivation of a guy like Bob Bollinger. He wants to make money with his radio stations, and that's the mandate that he gets from corporate. And so the extent to which you can send a message that says, we will listen or we will encourage our friends in San Diego to listen, that's the audience side, and that's essential to the success of a radio station. But also, as Aldous has counseled, you need to address the advertiser or the revenue side. And what I understand, I talked to John Elliott earlier today, too, Aldous, that there are people who, on their own, have gone to various advertisers either nationally or in the San Diego area and said, if you advertise on KLSD, I will patronize your business.
Absolutely. And actually, there's a way you can do that from our website to help you out there. We have a form you can download at the San Diego page at nonstopradio.com. And that form is, there's two forms. One's a listener form and one's a sponsor form. The sponsor form, you take, if you're listening from San Diego streaming or any other means, you take that form, you take it around the local advertisers or local businesses, organizations who you think might be interested, and all they sign on, they don't sign on for a dollar amount. They just say, look, if you keep Progressive Talk and KLSD, I am interested in the idea of sponsoring the station.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a really great opportunity to show Clear Channel and show Bob Bollinger that this is the right business opportunity to pursue, that to continue going with Progressive Talk. I mean, he's not a bad guy. I talked to him personally. He's a good guy. He wants to make money. He's a businessman. Let's show him this is the right business move.
Mm-hmm. And what else did you pick up from your conversation with him? Is it a done deal? Is the decision made?
The entire conversation was couched in terms of uncertainty. In other words, he was not at all saying, oh, yeah, no, we're switching and it's all business and don't feel bad. No, that was not the conversation. The conversation was, well, you know, this is the kind of thing that we do periodically for all of our stations, and this is not the only station where we're just taking a look at the budget and seeing you know, what our projections are for the next year. So, in other words, it's scaled back a lot. So we are having the facts, because I can tell you that was not the word from very reliable sources this time last week. This time last week it was changing. Mm-hmm. I mean, Air America had been informed they were losing their affiliate.
Yeah.
This time this week, now they're like, well, we're just taking a look at the budget, and we want to make sure it can make budget and do well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can tell you right now that that wouldn't have happened except for the pressure that has already been put on the station to keep Progressive Talk.
Oh, that's great. Now, Aldis Tyler, one of the other issues has been where exactly is this decision being made? Bree Walker and I were talking about this yesterday, and when I used to work for CBS, whenever a decision came down that local management didn't want to take responsibility for, they just said, oh, New York told us to do this. And so what we heard at one point was, oh, San Antonio told us to do this. That's the corporate HQ for Clear Channel. But you called San Antonio, and you got a different story.
Well, right. I did some investigation. I spent about an hour on the phone to San Antonio, to Clear Channel Radio's headquarters. And again, as I'm cautioning everyone else to do, I was very polite but firm. I said, look, I understand that it can be a little confusing sometimes. I understand the radio business is very fluid, but I need to know who to talk to, because I don't want to be putting pressure on anybody who isn't involved in this process. They don't deserve it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so with that frame in mind, they were very careful about getting me the correct information. And even though it took a little bit of doing, I can pretty much assure you that San Antonio has very little to do with this decision. If they have anything at all, it may have been a minor suggestion or two, but it is being made at the San Diego level,
mm-hmm.
at the KLSD level. Bob Bollinger is definitely big time in it. He did mention that his regional boss in Phoenix is also a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I did not get her name, but I'm going to look that up tonight.
Okay. Well, Aldis, I want to thank you. Again, two websites, one website, one email address, nonstopradio.com. Go to the San Diego page there. It's obvious on the homepage. And the email for the market manager in San Diego, the guy who is, we believe, responsible for the future of KLSD, BOBBOLINGER, Bob Bollinger at clearchannel.com. Thanks, Aldis.
And I confirmed that with Bob himself.
Okay, great. Well, keep us posted. We'll talk to you soon.
You're welcome, Peter. Thanks again. Keep us safe, man.
All right. See you later. And to your calls now in the Free Speech Zone. Lines available if you want to join us this hour at 888-5 Peter B. We go to Laird in Eureka. Hello, Laird.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Pretty good, thanks.
I'm kind of into the same thing that I've been into right from day one. Do you think that this whole thing with Iran is a cover-up for a power grab by the Bush administration?
Well, I can't rule it out, Laird. First of all, it is so just doggone crazy to try to stir up the hornet's nest further in the Middle East. That you have to wonder if Bush is trying to bring on the end times or Armageddon by approving a military assault on Iran. Now, he hasn't done so yet, but he keeps ramping up the threats, and we need to be very vigilant about this. And so it's not rational when you look at the incredible risks that we would be taking. And we would have to acknowledge at this point that we can't estimate what the cost would be to the United States in the form of retaliation from Iran and its allies. And so you can't really put this on a rational footing. But to drill into your original question, you raise a question that I cannot easily dismiss or just pass off, because we know that earlier this year there was an executive order that Bush signed grabbing more power domestically in the event of an attack or a natural disaster. And it is possible, of course, that if we attack Iran, that Hezbollah or other allies or acolytes of Iran would have cells in the United States and might cause us serious problems. And that could create the provocation or the pretext for Bush to declare martial law and attempt to extend his term in office.
I don't consider
it a likely prospect. I would hope that he understands how things work and would not try to do that. But, you know, this administration has gone well past the established limits in terms of grabbing power. And so we can't suspect that they wouldn't attempt more.
This business about suspicion of somebody because you didn't see them together at a party. OK, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay, I laugh at that. However, this administration does not seem to be too worried about what other people think.
Yeah.
They don't seem to be too worried about the future. It just they seem very complacent with where things are at, like they know something we don't.
Mm-hmm. Laird, I got to run to a break, but stay vigilant and remain skeptical.
Thanks.
And keep calling the program. I appreciate it.
Bye.
888-5 Peter B. We take a break and return. I'd like to hear from you. Any subject, any viewpoint, call me toll free. 888-573-8372. That's 1-888-5 Peter B. 19 after the hour on the Peter B. Collins Show. The Peter B. Collins Show. Rolling some stones your way this afternoon. We'll dedicate this one to Larry Craig.
You call yourself a Christian. I think that you're a hypocrite. You say you are a patriot. I think that you're a...
Oh, we got to be careful there. What rhymes with hypocrite anyway, huh? How come you're so wrong, my sweet neocon? That's the Rolling Stones from their last studio CD. I can't remember the name of it. And this just came in today. Brian Urban, our producer, who's taking your calls at 888-5-PETER-B, flashed me this story from The Guardian in Britain. Guitarist Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones has demanded the two Swedish newspapers apologize after they printed savage reviews of the band's performance in Gothenburg, including a comment that Keith appeared very drunk. The newspaper Aftonbladet claimed the guitarist looked a bit confused, while the Expressen paper had a headline that read, "The Stones' Drunken Scandal at Ullevi," and gave Richards zero stars for his performance. But Keith is not taking it. He said, "Never have I risen to the bait of a bad review, but this time I have to stand up for our incredible Gothenburg audience and for our fans all over Sweden to say that you owe them and us an apology." Earlier this month, Richards toppled over on stage at a show in Helsinki. And, of course, last year he fell out of a palm tree. Where was he, in Fiji or something like that? And I understand how he fell out. I don't know how he got up there. Anyway, his statement read, "You have a duty to wield the power of the press with honesty and integrity. There were 56,000 people in the stadium who bought a ticket and experienced a completely different show than the one you reviewed. How dare you cheapen the experience for them and for the hundreds of thousands of other people across Sweden who weren't there. Write the truth. It was a good show." Well, I saw the Stones 2 years ago in San Francisco on their tour at the ballpark. And they put on a great show. And Keith appeared to be sober. That's about all I can tell you. Ben and Salinas, thanks for your call. You're next here in the Free Speed Zone today.
Yeah, Peter, they said that the roadies had to hold him up to play. I mean, who's going to pay to see that?
Well, and I mean,
nobody's that good. I'm sorry, Charlie.
I wonder if he sobered up for the press conference.
Well, you know he did. His lawyer saw to that.
Yeah.
The president this morning said he wants $60 billion to continue the war in Iraq, plus a supplement of another $100 billion. Now, this supplement must be a way of getting around the general budget or to go outside of the budget and keep on looting the treasury, which they are very successfully doing.
No,
I say by the media of the Peter B. Collins Show, Nancy Pelosi, tie the next budgetary request, the $60 billion, to the stem cell research bill. And Mr. Bush, here it is. Take it or leave it. And Ms. Pelosi, do not dare to give us an attorney general who has only interests of Cheney and Bush in his repertoire.
Well, keep someone
that works for all the people.
Ben.
Or Pelosi, get out of town yourself, new sheriff that you are.
Okay, just keep in mind that Pelosi doesn't have a direct role in confirming the next attorney general. That is a Senate responsibility. But
Sorry, you know what? I'm picking on the wrong one. That would be Perry then.
Harry Reid. But, yeah. But you know, your notion is on target, that the leadership here needs to show some.
Well, he can't sign a bill that they don't put in front of him. Therein lies the wisdom, Charlie.
Indeed.
Calling you Charlie. Peter Collins.
That's okay. I don't care.
Yeah.
Ben, you are correct. It is the House of Representatives that must originate any bill that is an appropriation bill, such as the money the president has asked for.
That's in the Constitution.
And they don't have to give him what he asks for.
Yep.
And they, you know, benchmarks, timelines, all that kind of stuff, nice little window dressing, but don't give him the money he asks for.
They could say, here's $59 billion, take it or leave it. And here's the stem cell bill, it's tied to it. You buy the twins or you go home broke.
Or here's $59 billion to bring the troops home, and that's all it's for. Ben.
Charlie, thank you, Peter.
Okay.
Sorry about my confusion here.
All right, I'll be Charlie for the rest of the show. Call Charlie B. Collins right now. I want to hear from you, and we've got another half hour in the Free Speech Zone. Grab a line, toll free, 888-573-8372.
Now let's go to Mike of Metro Traffic. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Hal. Good afternoon. Good evening, I should say. Let's take a look at just a couple of problems we're going to let you know about. First of all, Carmel Valley Laurel's great at Miramonte Road. We do have a stalled bus blocking the right lane there. Also, San Juan Batista, San Juan Highway at Prescott. We had an accident there. It's a rental truck. It went off the roadway, landed in the middle of the field. CHP units on scene handling that situation. Looking at the Santa Cruz Mountains, no problems to report there on Highway 17, which is always good news. Northbound and southbound 1 between Monterey and Carmel, nothing to report there as well, which is excellent news. This report brought to you by Office Depot, free at Office Depot this week, a 4-pack of Post-it notes and 1-inch flags. Free after a mail-in savings limit. 1 quantities are limited as well. While supplies last, offer expires on 9-1. That is traffic on KRXA.
Love inside of me. Now tell me, what do you see?
Live from the left coast, it's the Peter B. Collins Show. Infused with dangerous San Francisco values like compassion, justice, and a living wage. Join the conversation toll-free at 1-888-5-PETER-B and be part of Peter B.'s America.
We're taking your calls in the free speed zone. Grab a line now, toll-free, 888-5-PETER-B.
Nature's waiting.
Minutes after the hour, 888-573-8372 if you'd like to join the conversation. And so far today, nobody's commented on Larry Craig, the senator from Idaho, who held a news conference yesterday to declare that he's not gay, never has been gay, and that he regrets pleading guilty to disorderly conduct charges that arose from a scene in a bathroom at the Minneapolis airport in June of this year. And, of course, it's just another curveball for the Republicans and another safe seat put at risk. And it is just bizarre when you try to understand what Larry Craig has told us, declaring his innocence, but it doesn't really add up with the information offered by the police. And his guilty plea kind of speaks for itself. Now he tells us that he regrets that he didn't tell his wife that he had pled guilty to this sex crime? And you just have to wonder, I mean, put yourself in that position. Now, it probably won't surprise you to hear that I'm not gay and that I don't seek sexual encounters with men. But I try to put it in my own context of, you know, what if I had a mistress or some sort of sexual escapade? What would I tell my partner? Well, we know that men often do lie to their wives and partners. But it doesn't make sense that he was picked up in June, he pled guilty in August, and he didn't tell his wife. Now, that suggests that the story of his innocence and the he said claim simply, you know, is beyond the realm of possibility, beyond the realm of truth. So right now, Brian is reviewing for broadcast quality control, and he's just given it a thumbs up, a clip that we'll play for you in a little bit. It's a dramatization of the incident in the bathroom in Minneapolis with Senator Craig. We'll get to that shortly. But Steve's on the line from Salinas, and he's got priority. Hello, Steve. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I was thinking about this Bush and trying to bomb Iran, especially the nuclear facility. It just seems really stupid to me because there's going to be nuclear fallout all over the place.
Well,
and that's going to affect everybody.
Well, you're right about that. I mean, nuclear weapons are not something that you just drop and walk away from. And, you know, because of the proximity of nations friendly and otherwise to Iran, the fallout field, the downwind area, could be extensive.
You know, we have soldiers in Afghanistan, which has a border with Iran. We have soldiers in Iraq that has a border with Iran. It's beyond the realm of conceivability to me. I don't know. But there's no level below which those guys will not stoop to do whatever they want to do. Thank you.
Okay. I appreciate the call. And now let's see who's next. It's Tom in Coos Bay. Tom, welcome. Listening to KBBR.
Hi, Peter. How's it going?
Pretty good.
Yeah, I heard your interview with Peter DeFazio a few days ago, unable to get on the phone, and I was kind of disturbed the way your callers, and I have to say it seems even you, were kind of getting down on him.
Okay, tell me why.
Well, it bothered me. I mean, I actually consider he's the best representative we have in Congress. I tend to agree with him about 99% of the time, and I'd say I'm about as far left and progressive and everything else as, you know, I think my bona fides are okay on that.
Mm-hmm.
And the few times I've kind of disagreed with his positions, actually, he's changed my mind.
Uh-huh.
And there's only one subject, which I won't bother getting into, where I tend to disagree with his positions, but, you know, basically I tend to agree with him. And I thought he gave you a very well-reasoned, I don't know if you call it an argument, but mm-hmm. at least a rationale for why he wasn't actively supporting impeachment. And I tend to agree with him on that. I tend to think that it can't happen. It's not, I mean, with the political reality we have right now, it's just not going to happen. It's not something to really make the primary issue, and especially since he's right about it, almost everything else. I heard some callers getting down on him. It troubled me.
Well, first of all, I respect your opinion, Tom, and I respectfully disagree, because in talking with your congressman, we had rich agreement on the need to impeach Alberto Gonzalez.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that the crimes of Dick Cheney and George Bush are as clear and obvious as those of Mr. Gonzalez.
Can we stop right there, Peter?
Sure.
Because this is exactly what Peter said. He said, what are you going to charge them with? What exactly are you going to charge President Bush? And obviously, you know, you have to impeach Dick Cheney first. What crimes are you going to charge them with?
Well, first of all, it would be with the rationale given for the invasion of Iraq, the non-existent WMD, the non-existent link between Saddam and 9/11.
I believe, if I remember right, Peter said that the Congress went along with that. I mean, it would be awfully hard for a Congress that went along with whatever the lies were, and I agree they were lies,
mm-hmm.
It would be hard for them to then say, well, you lied to us, we agreed with them then, but now we know that they were lies, and now we are going to impeach you for that. I think that's an awfully weak case to try to pull off.
Well, Tom, I understand that point, and I also agree that because Congress has continued to fund the war, that
mm-hmm.
their position is weakened. But I don't think that that means that the president didn't violate his oath of office in lying to us in the State of the Union message about the Niger connection, which he knew at that point to be false.
Yeah, so, no, I do agree that I think
he and
Cheney are the most impeachable
right?
pair that we've ever had in office. I mean, I absolutely, totally agree with
all
that.
Right,
I
so
even
then
had
let's,
an impeach thing on the back of my car for a while.
Then, Tom, let's focus more on the practical issues, all right? Because I think you and I are in agreement that, you know, maybe Congress has rubber-stamped some things that weaken the impeachability, but I still believe there are fundamental issues there that they can be held accountable for. So then it becomes a political calculation, and I believe the Democrats have frittered away 9 months of this year when they could have gotten proceedings underway. And as I've pointed out, I believe that just starting the process would have a chilling effect on the Bush administration and might cause them to take off the table any plans to attack Iran.
Okay.
And so I'm being very practical here, and,
uh-huh.
and I would not even expect that impeachment, if initiated next week, would result in the removal, ultimately, of Cheney or Bush. But it would air out the many misdeeds of this administration. It would put them on notice that they are being watched, and if they screw up again, they'll be removed from office, and it might stop another military adventure.
Well,
now,
you know,
Tom,
I totally agree.
Hold on.
President,
Tom,
we do have to stop.
Tom, let me jump in here, because this story just came in this afternoon. John Conyers of Michigan held a town hall meeting in his district yesterday, and to the credit of David Swanson and many other activists, he's feeling the pressure. And he responded to a question from a constituent. Nancy Pelosi has impeachment off the table, but that's off her table. It's not off John Conyers' table. He said, Nancy Pelosi, who I actually supported, cannot prevent me from introducing an impeachment resolution against, well, I've got a long list of people who are eligible.
Okay. I mean, well, yeah, and I respect John Conyers, too, and I don't think he's exactly actively on board. I mean, he's almost in the same position Peter DeFazio is. I mean, I don't think Peter's chairing a thing, but he's chair of some important subcommittees at the moment. I mean, they're part of what you would call the establishment. But when you said the Democrats, we're not the Republicans. We're not a phalanx. Peter DeFazio, he represents this area of Oregon almost perfectly. And quite frankly, we're about 50-50 in terms of being sort of red, sort of blue.
Mm-hmm.
And he manages to win elections by over 60% of the vote because he almost perfectly represents the feelings of the mm-hmm. people here.
Well, Tom, I need to move on to other callers, but I appreciate your commentary. I always respect people who call to disagree with me, and I enjoy hearing contrary points of view. And finally, what I would add is that when Mr. DeFazio started to get phone calls from listeners who wanted to urge him to do what they see as his duty to proceed with impeachment, I felt he was condescending.
Can I add one word quickly?
Sure.
I thought they were rather arrogant, and I've attended a lot of Peter DeFazio meetings. I've talked to him personally. They aren't Oregonians. I heard what they said, and I think the arrogance was more in your callers than Peter's response.
All right. Very good, Tom.
Okay.
Thanks for the call today, and I'm glad to hear your disagreement. 888-5-PETER-B. Back to your calls in just a moment. And here is a clip. You can get this at HuffingtonPost.com. And Paul Hipp made this audio file, and it is based on the police report of the incident at the Minneapolis airport with Senator Larry Craig of Idaho.
On June 11th, 2007, at about 1200 hours, I was working a plainclothes detail involving lewd conduct in the main men's public restroom of the North Star Crossing in the Lindbergh Terminal. The airport police department has received civilian complaints and has made numerous arrests regarding sexual activity in the public restroom. I entered the men's restroom and proceeded to an unoccupied stall in the back. At 12:13 hours, I could see an older white male with gray hair standing outside my stall. He was standing there about 3 feet away and had a roller bag with him. The male was later identified by Idaho driver's license as Larry Edwin Craig. I could see Craig look through the crack in the door from his position. Craig would look down at his hands, fidget with his fingers, and then look through the crack into my stall again. Craig would repeat the cycle for about 2 minutes. I was able to see Craig's blue eyes as he looked into my stall. At 12:15 hours, the male in the stall to my left flushed the toilet and exited the stall. Craig entered the stall and placed his roller bag against the front of the stall door. From my seated position, I could observe the shoes and ankles of Craig seated to the left of me. He was wearing dress pants with black dress shoes. At 12:16, Craig tapped his right foot. I recognized this as a signal used by persons wishing to engage in lewd conduct. Craig tapped his toes several times and moved his foot closer to my foot. I moved my foot up and down slowly. While this was occurring, the male in the stall to my right was still present. At 12:17 hours, I saw Craig swipe his hand under the stall divider for a few seconds. The swipe went in the direction from the front of the stall back towards the back wall. His palm was facing towards the ceiling as he guided it along the stall divider. I was only able to see his fingers on my side of the stall divider. Craig swiped his hand again for 2 seconds in the same motion to where I could see more of his fingers. Craig then swiped his hand in the same motion. I could see that it was Craig's left hand due to the position of his thumb. I could also see Craig had a gold ring on his finger as his hand was on my side of the stall divider. At about 12:19 hours, I held my police identification in my right hand down on the floor so that Craig could see it. With my left hand near the floor, I pointed towards the exit. Craig responded, "No." I again pointed towards the exit. Craig exited the stall with his roller bag without flushing the toilet, without causing disturbance. I discreetly motioned for Craig to exit the restroom. I noticed that not all the stalls were occupied. Craig demanded to see my credentials. I told Craig that he was under arrest. He had to go. And I didn't want to make a scene. Craigraft.
A dramatic reading of the police report in the case of Senator Larry Craig. We're going to take a break and return to more of your phone calls. Thanks for listening today to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Mike from Metro.
Hey, thanks very much, Al. Really, things looking pretty good for the most part. Really, no major stalls or accidents report. Taking a look at the Santa Cruz Mountains, traffic moving fine in both directions there, northbound and southbound. Just a reminder that we're letting you know that it's Spare the Air Day, so that means that the Valley Transportation Authority is saying that buses or light rail today and tomorrow will be free. Caltrain and BART, by the way, will only be free until it looks like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So if you're traveling on that means of transportation, just be advised there. And then that, no problems to report in Monterey or Carmel at this point. This report brought to you by Office Depot, free at Office Depot this week. A four-pack of Post-it notes, 1-inch flags, free after a mail-in remake. Quantities limited, while supplies last. Offer expires on 9/1. That is traffic on KRXA.
That's great, Mike. Thanks. And sorry for all the technical problems we've been having, but we're kind of at the end of the tunnel. Looks like we may get there. I want to thank Mark Haas very, very much. Mark, you're the man.
Woohoo!
And that means it's better work, or else people are going to be like, what the hell happened with Haas? They've already got it fixed.
Congressman Peter DeFazio,
mm-hmm.
And I think the man is a great congressman, and I would like to see him get, you know, I'd love to see him become a United States Senator, even President of the United States, even. I think the leadership of the Democratic Party could use someone like Peter DeFazio in their leadership. But I agree with you on the impeachment issue. It is Peter DeFazio who is arrogant and smug on the impeachment issue, not people like me who have been calling for him to support impeachment. So I would just have to say to my South Coast brother from Coos Bay, he's absolutely wrong on that.
Okay.
Okay. Now, about Larry Craig,
mm-hmm.
You know, I just got to thinking about Larry Craig today, and I came up with a great advertising idea. Just think about it. Larry Craig toilet paper. With lipstick on it.
That says, I'm not gay, and I never was gay.
Hey, that's it. That's a good idea, man.
And then there'll be a little asterisk. However, I do recognize that only a man knows how to really pleasure a man.
So you got to give me credit for coming up with the idea there, Peter.
It's all yours. Thanks for the call today. Appreciate it. Jake in Arcata, welcome.
Hey, Peter B.
Hi.
You know, I expect one day in the future to be traveling to the Minneapolis airport and to find the Larry Craig Memorial robo-toilet, you know. Did you hear about those robo-toilets that the one mayor down there apparently in Florida or something wanted to install where they would open automatically so there wouldn't be any public sex that couldn't happen?
I see. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Well, the other thing that's interesting is that it's kind of surfaced that there is a network of gay men who meet in airport restrooms. And so it's possible that this was not Larry's first bathroom encounter.
Well, yeah, apparently CBS was running the story this morning. Back in 1982, I believe, there was this congressional page scandal back then, much like the Mark Foley incident.
Right.
And the only congressman to come forward, no congressmen were named, but it was Larry Craig, who was named the congressman from Idaho, came forward to deny an accusation that hadn't been made against him, kind of like that little press conference he gave, you know, saying he wasn't gay and had never been gay.
Hey, I'm not gay.
Yeah, like it's, you know, like it's the end of the world if you're gay. Well, I guess if you're a Republican politician, it's the end of your political career.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Jake, I want to jump because I got a bunch of callers. Thank you. Billy Sunshine wants to issue an apology.
Yeah, I want to apologize to you and your audience for not being slavish and devotional towards a representative. It's true he gave a reasoned explanation as to where he stood. But I sort of thought I had the right not to accept it, not to see the world his way. And one more thing, Peter.
Yeah.
Remember the way the Constitution reads, the way he swore to uphold, and that is not, you might, if you feel like it or it's safe for your seat, take a person who commits crimes and misdemeanors against the state. No. You shall. Shall is the word. Shall means you got to do it.
Isn't that Middle English, though? We can ignore it, right?
No, I don't think so. I understand the meaning of the word of the Constitution, my friend.
Billy, would you like me to roll the Apologia chorus?
Please.
Excuse me.
I will, you know, have more respect for my political class in the future, I promise.
Well, I was glad to get both calls.
Yeah,
I think, you know, Tom raises some important points, and I'm happy to hear his viewpoint. I think that maybe Peter DeFazio isn't used to Billy Sunshine. And, you know, you do have a strong voice and you're passionate and you came on somewhat aggressively.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that he should have the experience and the aplomb, if you will, to respond and say thank you for your passion. And here are the three reasons why I don't want to do it.
I respect your answer and think you nailed it as usual.
Okay, Billy. Thank you. John in Carmel Valley, you're on the air.
You know, I've got this memorial of Life magazine coming out after 9/11, and there were a whole bunch of these. And I was going to comment on some stuff in there because there's an introduction by Bush, and I could go on and on. But I decided to ask you a question in particular. I know you're much more knowledgeable about the whole conspiracy thing than I am. Did they ever determine from the cleanup that did they find conclusively the remains of any of the hijackers?
Well, we don't really know that, and it still is an open question that has never been resolved. There are, I don't want to misstate, but I believe there are at least four individuals who have the same name as those who were named as hijackers on 9/11, who are alive and well, and I believe they're all living in Saudi Arabia. And certainly there can be multiple people with the same name. We've seen some grisly cases of a mistaken identity, including the German guy who was rounded up because his name was the same Al-Masri as an Al-Qaeda guy we were looking for. And he was subjected to rendition and torture and finally just left on a dirt road in the middle of the night. So I understand that those kinds of things can happen. But, again, we haven't been told the full truth about 9/11. Some of the cover-ups protect interests of the Saudi Arabian royal family. We don't, I mean, we know that, 16 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi citizens. And, again, that at least a couple, if not as many as four of those names, are individuals who are still living on this planet and could not have been on airliners that flew into buildings or hit the Pentagon on 9/11. Well, thanks, John. I'm out of time here. We'll be back at you tomorrow, same time, same stations. And I hope you'll listen again for the Peter B. Collins Show.
Until we meet again, happy travels.
Miguel Sarmiento, owner and chef of the Mexicali Grill in New Monterey, cordially invites you to visit his restaurant and enjoy quality Mexican food prepared with California seasonings and sauces, all with personalized, attentive service. Miguel has more than 14 years of experience preparing Italian, Hawaiian, Mexican, French, and American dishes in restaurants throughout Monterey County. Looking to savor the best Mexicali cuisine served with great margaritas or fine imported or domestic beers? Visit the Mexicali Grill today, located at 204 Lighthouse Avenue at the corner of Reeside Avenue in New Monterey. The Mexicali Grill is open daily for lunch from 11 to 3 and for dinner from 5 to 9. For takeout orders, call 375-9801. That's 375-9801. Miguel has a message for all Central Coast residents who appreciate delicious, high-quality Mexican food at reasonable prices.
Todos son bienvenidos en el Mexicali Grill. Try us. You'll like us a lot.
You're listening to KLXA 540, now the CBS News.
He's telling the truth or not, but I just found them, not credible. The most important thing here is that, he decided to plead guilty to what I believe are some pretty ugly charges.
Charges of disorderly conduct in an airport men's room, charges which Senator Larry Craig now denies. A growing number of Republican lawmakers calling on him to call it quits. He is agreeing to step down from his ranked position on several Senate committees. It's 2 years after Katrina, and CBS's Cammy McCormick is in New Orleans.
Even while they remembered the victims and vowed to rebuild, there was anger at the federal government.
George Bush and the federal government, you've got to stop being chicken and
local leaders like Mayor Ray Nagin were also defending their efforts.
You can talk about we should be much further than we are, but the bottom line is this city is totally devastated.
We called it the worst natural and man-made disaster in the country's history. Cammy McCormick, CBS News, New Orleans.
President Bush did make a stopover in New Orleans today. That Chinese 737 that exploded on a runway in Okinawa, it caused the FAA to call on airlines here to inspect their 737. CBS's Nancy Cordes.
What the FAA is now saying is that the situation is serious enough that the airlines need to speed up their inspections of these late model 737s. Previously, the FAA gave them 24 days. Now they have just 10 days. And the reason is that as the airlines started to inspect some of their 737s, they found several more incidents of these bolts coming loose, and that's what could puncture a fuel tank.
Yeah, four planes turning up with wing abnormalities. Richard Jewell was not a well man.
At home sick since about the end of February with diabetes, and he had had some toes amputated. He also had some kidney problems.
Coroner Johnny Worley talking about the security guard wrongly accused of being the Atlanta Olympics bomber.
No, he did not talk about it, but it was. I'm sure it was hard for him to get along without hearing about it, because every time he was sort of a, I guess most people looked at him as a celebrity, Richard Jewell. So it was hard for him to forget it.